There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Uh-huh.
Venus.
Why not? We bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it, the other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots, independent media, and our media environment. My name is Paul Reisman. I'm your host at the controls today, Media Geek producer Drew Tirico. On today's program, we'll talk about pirate radio. 40 watts to freedom. 40 watts to nowhere, actually, I believe.
That's right. 40 watts from nowhere.
From nowhere. Well, I'll get it right eventually. We'll hear an interview with the author of this new book as conducted by Freak Radio Santa Cruz. And, of course, we'll take a gander at what's going on the week in news of our media environment. Do stay tuned. Media Geek News features stories about our communications environment that typically get relegated to the business pages of our newspapers and often don't get reported at all in the electronic media. News on media and communications industries is not just of interest to investors and stockholders. It's important to all of us, especially if we want to have a role in changing our media environment to serve our needs in a more democratic society.
On Thursday, March 18th, the Federal Communications Commission took demonstrative steps in its Congress-appeasing effort to crack down on broadcast indecency. The commission announced a fine of $27,000 against a Viacom Infinity-owned radio station in Detroit for broadcasting an episode of The Howard Stern Show, and a fine of $55,000 against two Florida stations owned by a Clear Channel subsidiary, Capcom, for a morning broadcast containing, quote, a dialogue between the hosts and a man and a woman while they were engaging in actual or simulated sexual intercourse, end quote. The FCC's commissioners also announced a more striking decision to overrule their own enforcement bureau's decision that U2 singer Bono's use of the F-word during a live broadcast of the Golden Globes Award show on NBC was not indecent. In the FCC's original decision, it ruled that the broadcast did not violate the indecency prohibition because Bono's use of the quote-unquote F-word had been fleeting and in a non-sexual context. According to an FCC press release, in overruling the previous decision, the commissioners, quote, emphasized that all broadcast licensees are on clear notice that similar broadcasts in the future will lead to forfeitures and political license and potential license revocation, if appropriate, end quote. All five FCC commissioners voted to change the ruling. However, they split on deciding whether or not to impose a fine, with a majority consisting of two Republicans and one Democrat deciding against it. It is important to keep in mind that according to federal law and legal precedent, indecent programming is only banned during the hours of 6 a.m. to 10 p.m., when it is presumed that children are most likely to be watching or listening. The period after 10 p.m. is known as the free harbor time, during which broadcasters may air more challenging program that is aimed at adults, such as the F-word and even nudity. Fines for indecency, therefore, may only be imposed for programming that airs between 6 a.m. and 10 p.m. Congress is still considering raising the maximum fine for an incident of indecency from $27,500 to $500,000.
Vermont's unlicensed community radio station, Radio Free Brattleboro, won a minor court victory on Monday when the federal court refused to grant the FCC's request for a preliminary injunction to shut down the station. A preliminary injunction would have forced a 10-watt station off the air. David Kirby, a U.S. attorney from Burlington representing the FCC, argued that RFB was broadcasting illegally because it does not have a license and maintained the broadcast caused, quote, irreparable harm, unquote, to the government. Station attorneys James Maxwell and Larry Hillis argued that the FCC had lost the public trust by favoring large media corporations over community radio and that the station's shutdown would cause, quote, irreparable harm, end quote, to the Brattleboro community. Because no license is available to 10-watt stations, the people of Brattleboro represent the station's authority to operate, the station's lawyers maintained. The face-off in court was the first stage of a legal battle between the FCC and the volunteer-run station, which has been under threat of shutdown since June 2003, when it was first visited by the FCC. The station has gathered signatures of more than 2,000 Brattleboro residents and received a resolution of support from the Brattleboro Select Board. Also, earlier this month, the town's voters showed support for the station with a 1,519 to 780 vote in favor of a ballot question in support of RFB. Early in the court proceedings, Hillis objected to the FCC's characterization of the station as, quote, pirate radio, end quote, saying that a pirate is, quote, someone that steals something from someone else, end quote, and the airwaves are public property. Later, Block and the team more appropriately later, Block said, a station volunteer, that the term more appropriately applies to the FCC, which in the mid-1970s stopped licensing small stations and, quote, denied thousands of communities access to their own voices, end quote. Judge J. Garvin Murtha set an April 30th deadline for both sides to file additional information in the case and a May 21st deadline for rebuttals. The judge is seeking additional information from both sides. From the lawyers representing the FCC, Murtha said he wants a clarification on the FCC's timeline to accept applications for 10-watt radio stations and information on the commission's history of awarding license waivers. And that's a bit of what's been going on in our radio environment. You're listening to Media Geek. Coming up in just a moment, we'll be hearing an interview with the author of a new book about pirate radio in Los Angeles called 40 Watts from Nowhere. And I want to alert you to a couple of things coming up in Media Geek in future weeks. On April 23rd, host of Democracy Now!, Amy Goodman, will be here in the Media Geek studios. We'll be asking her about independent media, alternative media, and its role right now in these trying times. And we're looking for input from you, the Media Geek listener, of what you'd like to ask Amy Goodman. We'll take your questions by email in the next few weeks and go through them and ask her some of the best ones. We are looking for questions that really focus on the issue of media, especially grassroots and independent media. Send them to me, paul@mediageek.org. Of course, I always welcome your input and suggestions at that address. Also coming up on April 2nd, which is our first Pledge Drive show at Media Geek, we're going to do a review of media ownership in the Champaign-Urbana area, something you'll never read about in the News Gazette, so you will want to tune into that. We'll be back in just a moment.
And that was a little bit of Pitch Shifter from back in the old days of 1998, was it?
Very old days, yeah. 1998, www.pitchshifter.com.
That's right. Well, this is from the explosion of electronic music before the internet bubble burst. Seems like a long time ago. Well, now we're going to do our interview. Well, it's not our interview, but an interview with Sue Carpenter. And she's the author of a new book that's called 40 Watts from Nowhere, A Journey into Pirate Radio. And the book recounts her tale of founding a pirate station called KPBJ in San Francisco and then KBLT in Los Angeles. And in this interview done with the V-Man, host of pirate station Freak Radio Santa Cruz's show Rockin' the Boat, Sue gives a voice to her struggle against boring corporate radio. So they start off from a nice beginning point. We'll let them take it away.
Take us back to the beginning, Sue. Your quest to operate a pirate radio station began in early 1995 in the law offices of Peter Frank. He mentioned Stephen Dunifer's case. Of course, listeners here are familiar with Free Radio Berkeley. But Stephen Dunifer's case piqued your interests about pirate radio. Tell us how it all started. Who did you enlist in your journey and your impressions of these people?
Well, it started out of absolute ignorance on my part. I was an extremely naive 28-year-old who walked into an attorney's office thinking that I could buy a license and that that would gain me access to the FM airways, and of course that illusion was quickly shattered. The attorney that I was meeting with was one of a team of attorneys who is representing Stephen Denifer in his landmark case against the FCC, which was basically saying that the FCC wasn't regulating the airwaves in the public interest and contesting their regulations on First Amendment rights grounds. So that put me in touch with Stephen Denifer, and that was kind of my entree into this whole alternate universe that if you asked Stephen Denifer is micro radio, if you asked me at the time, I would have called it pirate radio. And yeah, it kind of threw me into a very political landscape that I wasn't very familiar with or comfortable with, because what I was interested in doing was starting a station that had everything to do with music, that was going to be playing music nonstop and was going to be playing kind of the cream of the crop of college radio fare. But when KBLT took off in Los Angeles, it really kind of flowered way beyond that to expand.
I found it very interesting in the beginning of your book to read about some of the characters who actually helped you get on the air in the early days when it was KPBJ, the San Francisco pirate station. Maybe give us a sense of some of these folks. They were Food Not Bombs activists and other folks, too. Give us just a little deeper picture of who these people were.
These are people that I would have considered kind of political radicals, very traditional Bay Area, very politically oriented, very socially conscious people, such as Stephen Denifer, who was working to get many different types of voices on the air. Then there was Richard Edmondson, who was running his own station out of the Sunset District of San Francisco, and his was, again, a very politically oriented station. And the person who helped me most in terms of actually getting my station on the air was named Chris Allen, and he was somebody who was involved in Food Not Bombs. He was involved in Stephen Denifer's group. He was very involved in bicycle rights, things along those lines. Stephen Denifer, I really admired what he was doing, but my interactions with him, he seemed very suspicious of someone like me kind of taking up his cause, but taking it up with a different intention. And at the time, he really didn't think that micro radio should be used for music broadcasting. He didn't see, like he does now, because in researching the book, he seems to have come around to this, that there's just as much of a need to get a diversity of music on the airwaves as there is to get a diversity of political viewpoints on the air.
He termed what you were attempting to do as a vanity station, is that right?
Yes, he did.
I think it's interesting because Free Radio Santa Cruz has always sort of tried to strike a balance between the two, mm-hmm. between vanity and also, you know, lifeline to the community. I'm wondering why you felt that you wanted to do strictly music on your station at the beginning.
Because I felt like the other stations that were on the air in a micro radio capacity, and there were three others in the Bay Area, were all doing that well. There was Radio X, which was kind of championing Latino liberal causes, and then there was Free Radio Berkeley, and there was San Francisco Liberation Radio, and I felt like they were all kind of filling that void, and that was the void that they wanted to fill. And I wasn't a very political person. I would consider myself a liberal person. I would consider myself interested in various social causes, but not an activist in that sense. I'm more of an artistic kind of person, more of a creative person. Always have been an admirer of music. I just never felt like I was having the opportunity to hear as much good music as was being made. And so that's why I wanted to take my stations in that direction.
One of the more entertaining aspects of the book I found was, just as somebody who's been doing this for 9 years, was your hunt for frequency. And maybe just touch upon, just briefly even, just what it's like to actually have to go through the trouble as someone with not a whole lot of technical abilities as yourself. What did you have to go through in order to find your frequency to broadcast on?
Well, the really nice thing about being somebody who doesn't know anything about radio technology is that there are plenty of people who do, and if they believe in what you're doing, they're more than happy to get involved. And so the process of finding a frequency for me was first the process of finding an engineer who wanted to get involved in what I was doing. So the engineer that I had been working with at my station up in San Francisco agreed to come down to Los Angeles and and helped me find the frequency down here. And he had been doing a little legwork, like poking around on the FCC website and trying to figure out what stations were licensed on what frequencies, at what powers, and from what locations. And he had figured out a couple different areas that he thought we might be able to squeeze on the dial, places on the dial that weren't too close to stations that were operating at high powers and also were geographically close to where we were planning to broadcast from. So it was our first night down in Los Angeles, and we were just kind of driving around, tuning across the dial, listening to see where there were more fuzzy spots and places that were further apart from already licensed high power stations. And it was just a process of very slowly tuning across the dial, being in a very high part of the area that we were planning, like the highest altitude. We were looking for the highest hill in the area so that we could pick up as many signals as possible, like at the strongest signals that we could at that particular location. And he was looking at a map, a topographical map of the area. He had a list of the different radio stations that were broadcasting around there and from where and what powers. And then we just kind of crept across the dial, and the frequency we were at in Los Angeles was 104.7. And the closest station that was broadcasting on that particular frequency was in Oxnard, which was about 60 or 70 miles north of us. And we just happened to be, Silver Lake was protected by the Santa Monica Mountains, so their signal really kind of dropped out once you got into Los Angeles, and so that was the place where we ended up.
And you're listening to an interview with Sue Carpenter, author of a new book on pirate radio called 40 Watts from Nowhere. The interview comes to us courtesy of Freak Radio Santa Cruz in Santa Cruz, California, and the V-Man who hosts the program Rockin' the Boat. And you're listening to Media Geek, weekly look at the world of grassroots independent media and our media environment. My name is Paul Reese-Madel, and Drew Tirico, producer, is at the controls. And now we return you to this interview.
There was also another pirate operating at your frequency, is that right?
Yes, there was, which we didn't know about because we were setting up the station on Thanksgiving. And it seemed like it was the only place to go, and it seemed like we were the only ones who were going to be broadcasting a micro signal on that frequency. And we found out we were wrong because come January, there was another station we found out that was conflicting with our signal, and the reason why is because it was broadcasting out of the University of Southern California, and they had a pre-existing micro radio station that had been on the air for at least 10 years, sanctioned by the university, and they were broadcasting at 104.7, and unfortunately they were only 6 miles away from where I was broadcasting, and even though they were also at very low power, I think they were around about 40 watts as well, our proximity meant that there was an area where our two signals kind of overlapped. And it was really odd because we were the only two stations on that frequency in Los Angeles, and the city is like 450 square miles.
You were the proud to premiere a number of records before they were actually being released in stores. Can you tell us about this? And also tell us a little bit of some of the more notables to set foot in the KBLT studios.
To answer your first question about records that kind of premiered on KBLT before they actually hit other radio stations, I would say the most notable was Beck's Odelé, and that was, I came into possession of an advanced copy of that record because of my position at UHF, that little fashion culture music magazine that I was editing, and because it's a magazine, when you're reviewing music, it's considered long lead press, so you get music long before, like a newspaper would. And I was given a copy of his record 3 months before it came out, and of course, in my dual role as pirate radio operator, I took advantage of having that cassette to air that on KBLT as well.
And did Geffen Records really threaten to shut down or turn you into the FCC?
Well, you know, that's like hearsay, because later on, Beck's A&R person became an official DJ at KBLT, and I asked him that, and he said that was ridiculous, but I had heard through a couple different people who knew people at Geffen that they were unhappy about it and they were considering turning me in. But I wasn't able to ever verify that. That was just hearsay. But when somebody did warn me that that was happening within Geffen, I decided it was smarter to stop playing the record than risk the entire operation.
So with your connection at UHF, you were able to be in touch with a lot of music industry personnel, and the word spread quickly around the Silver Lake area, which was an up-and-coming hotbed at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so tell us, Mike Watt was one of the hosts of a radio program at your station,
mm-hmm.
Notable bass player of the Minutemen and Firehose, one of my favorite musicians, in fact. Tell us some of the other notables who made their way through your infamous studios.
Oh, goodness gracious. Well, I would say that pretty much every local band in the area made their way through at some point. But in terms of bigger profile bands, we had the Flaming Lips, we had the Jesus and Mary Chain, Red Hot Chili Peppers played live. There were a bunch of indie acts that came through, such as Barbara Manning. Goodness gracious, there were so many, and of course now I'm blinking out. Mazzy Star played our first benefit. Lita Husick, she was a regular DJ as well. Judah Bauer from the John Spencer Blues Explosion.
And the eventual demise of KBLT, you were indeed visited upon by the FCC. Tell us that story briefly.
Well, KBLT got too big for its britches, apparently. It was just, everybody seemed to know about it, and everybody eventually encompassed the FCC. And so the KBLT had been written about on some sort of pirate fan site, and the FCC saw it, and they knew the frequency, they knew we were broadcasting out of Silver Lake, and so one day they just decided to drive up and take us down. But the thing is that they ran into the station that was broadcasting out of USC first, because the FCC field office is in Cerritos, which is south of Los Angeles. So driving up from the south, they're going to run into USC first before they get to Silver Lake. They ended up getting to their station first, the one at USC campus. Fortunately, somebody from that station knew somebody from my station, called us, said, "We just got shut down. They're on their way to you." They thought we were you, and that gave us enough time to turn everything off before they got there. That bought us some time to set up a new type of transmission system, because it had been broadcasting directly from my house. So then we did a studio transmitter uplink situation where we were broadcasting over an unused UHF carrier from my house. That was all the DJ, everything that was going on over the air was being broadcast on that signal to another transmitter at the top of a high-rise in Hollywood, which is at the corner of Sunset and Vine. It was the highest building in the area. And then that was rebroadcast from there. It was transmitted out at a much lower power. We dropped it down to 8 watts because we no longer needed 40 watts, and with 8 watts and at that location, we were getting the entire city, but that, of course, was problematic, because if everybody can hear you, once again, the FCC can hear you. So we had these two glorious weeks of getting calls from all these far-flung places and new listeners, and it was definitely the KBLT's heyday, but what happened is they found where we were broadcasting. They went on top of this roof of this high-rise, and it was a Thursday morning, and the station just went static. And so we checked all the equipment at my house. Everything seemed to check out. So we went to the remote location at this high-rise. We opened up the transmitter box, and somebody had opened up the box, turned off the switch, closed the box back up. So we knew that whoever it was who had turned off the station knew radio equipment enough that they didn't have to just cut the cord. So us being all high on ourselves, we decided just to turn it back on. And the next day the same thing happened. And, you know, you just, when something like that happens, you just want to know who it is, because it didn't necessarily have to be the FCC. It could have been like a competing pirate. It could have been somebody who didn't like what we were doing but knew radio enough to be able to track where we were broadcasting from. But I just wanted to know. And so I ended up kind of going to my grave, so to speak. I went out. I rode myself out to the remote transmitter location and got out on the 20th floor and was in the stairwell, and I heard voices, and I knew that I should have just turned around, but I didn't. And I just kept walking up the stairs and ran into this old man who seemed very pleased to see me. And he dug in his pocket. He pulled out a card, like literally a business card, not a badge like I had envisioned. It was just a card. And it took me a while to see it, but eventually in little small type, I saw Federal Communications Commission, and I knew that was it. So he asked me, he just kind of pointed his thumb upstairs. He goes, "Are you going up there?" And I said, "Are you?" And he knew that it was me who was doing it, and he gave me the option of either confiscating the equipment or giving me a fine of $10,000. And so I said he could take the equipment because it was only worth about $500. And that was that.
And that's the end of KBLT. And we're nearing the end of the program. I want to ask you one final question, the most important question. We have just a minute left. Was it worth it, and would you do it again?
Definitely worth it. But doing it again, I would have to start from where I left off, which to me would feel like pushing a boulder.
Your thoughts on the low-power FM legalization scheme that the FCC pushed through in the year 2000?
My thoughts on that?
Yes.
Not enough. I think that there can be far more stations in more highly populated areas.
And stations like ours, still in defiance of the FCC, your thoughts on the future for pirate radio?
It'll always exist as long as people don't feel like they have a voice on the radio. And my thoughts on stations like yours, more power to you.
And that's Sue Carpenter, author of a new book called 40 Watts or Nowhere, about her experiences running a pirate radio station in both San Francisco and in Los Angeles. And you know, Drew, I'm actually about two-thirds of the way through that book.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's pretty good. I mean, she is a magazine freelance writer, and I think that's reflected in her prose. It's breezy. And, you know, she's kind of cagey with the political issues, as
right.
she mentions in the interview.
Yeah, she is a little bit kind of avoidant of that. But, you know, I guess it is understandable that someone wants to come at the pirate radio angle from a purely sort of, like she, I think she mentioned at one point in the interview, very creative standpoint.
Yeah, culture and art.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably, I think, personally, I think it's naive to think that somehow that can stand outside of politics. Obviously,
I think so
she's
too.
Up, when you're running a pirate radio station, you're right up against politics and the law and the enforcement of it. And I don't think that she shies away from that. It's interesting because she notes in a book in her first conversation with Stephen Dunifer that, you know, as soon as she's told him what she wanted to do, he was just, he really gave her a talking to about, well, this is a movement. And Stephen Dunifer is quite actually infamous for that in the movement. And within, I've talked to a lot of people who have been unlicensed broadcasters either currently or sometime. And that is one of the bigger debates often within even that small community is, you know, how valid is it to do mostly music, or should it always be very political, should always be sort of very talk based? And also, how valid is it, you know, for someone to do it, you know, in a way, just a few people, a small cadre, or even one person to do it out of their home, or should it be more like a WEFT community radio station? And sometimes those smaller stations are dismissed as so-called vanity stations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Well, she was called a vanity station by Stephen Dunifer, I know, but she did run her station more like a community radio station, as far as I can tell.
She had all these people she barely knew.
Exactly. Like a collective devoted to music. And she did mention at one point in the interview, actually, that I cut out, unfortunately, but she said that none of the radio stations in L.A., including the college stations or any of the other stations, had any sort of public access available to the people to get on the air. So she was really one of the only options, you know, her pirate radio station and other pirate radio stations maybe in the LA area, those are the only options for people to get on the air without being broadcast professionals.
I think that's what, especially if you live in a town like Champaign-Urbana, which has had WEFT, and even has other outlets like the Parkland radio station, which if you take their classes, you can get on the air with, and even the Planet, where students can get on the air, that there are very few other options in many cities, especially a city as large as Los Angeles. There is KPFT, which is the Pacifica station there, which is a community radio station, but certainly during the time that her pirate station was on the air in the mid-90s, Pacifica was a very turbulent place. I'm not sure how easy it would have been for someone to just get on the air quickly. That brings us to the close of another edition of Media Geek. We'll be back in 1 week with more news about grassroots and independent media and our media environment. In the meantime, you can catch up with independent media news at the Media Geek website, www.mediageek.org. There you can also download and listen to the archive editions of the program in MP3 in the open source Ogg Vorbis format. Media Geek is produced live at the studios of Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, Illinois. Some pre-production happens at the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center. Media Geek's producer is Drew Tirico, and I'm Paul Riesmandel. The Media Geek radio show is free to rebroadcast by non-commercial stations for non-profit purposes. Please contact us for permission to excerpt. Email me at paul@mediageek.org. Thanks for tuning in.